And we are back. We are talking to two SR-71 pilots, Rich Graham and Pat Halloran. We kind of led up to the actual missions of the SR-71 in the late 60s. But Rich, before we talk about that, how did you find flying the F-4? You mentioned that you'd flown that.
Flying
the
what?
The F-4.
The F-4?
Yeah.
F-4 was a good airplane for its job. I always characterize the F-4 as a jack of all trades, but a master of none.
Okay.
It was good for air-to-air, good for air-to-ground. And, of course, to me, the evolution of the F-16 and the F-15 for specific roles was the outgrowth of Vietnam and the way we used it over there as a jack of all trades.
So we're as I said, moving up to the actual missions of the SR-71. What went into the planning of your missions? I mean, how were the missions selected, first of all, and then what did you do as pilots to fulfill that mission?
Well, the initial planning and program and the information as to what the routes to be and the targets to be came down to us from the reconnaissance center at SAC headquarters in Omaha. And they, in turn, had got target assignments from the Joint Reconnaissance Center in Washington, D.C. So it was a very convoluted way to go find a target and go fly to it. And then we had mission planners of our own, of course. And once the word came down as to where they wanted us to go and what specific targets, then the planning would be done locally as to how do you actually get there and what time you're going to take off and who's going to fly and all that stuff. That was local. But the initial target selection was way above us, unfortunately.
Rich, as you got ready for missions, I mean, how did, once the target selected, how do you then fulfill that?
Well, picking up from where General Halloran's talking of the frag order coming down from SAC, the crews, your mission planning started the day before. We would show up at operations, say, around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The mission planners would already have the route of flight on the map drawn out. You have your computer flight planned, and you would sit there as a crew, as a pilot, and your navigator, the RSO, in the back seat. Don and I were crewed together. We would go through the whole route of flight and do what I call a what-if drill. And we would say, what if we were low on fuel here? What if we lose an engine here? What if we get electronic indications of a SAM or something being fired? So we go through this whole route of flight and do a drill about what we're going to do, because it cruising along at 2,000 miles an hour, you don't have a lot of time to think about it. You need to have a good game plan to start with, and that's what we did in the mission planning. And it would last about an hour, maybe 2 hours, 3 hours of your mission planning. And that's the day before.
Okay. And then the day of the mission?
Day of mission, you'd wake up, say, at 6 o'clock in the morning. The first thing you do is drive down to a facility at either Okinawa or Mildenhall, where we flew our two locations. And you would eat a high-protein, low-residue meal of steak and eggs. Once you had your meal, you'd go to operations and go through a briefing. The briefing lasted maybe 30 minutes, 35 minutes. And from there, the primary crew would get out and start getting suited up. The backup crew would then go out and pre-flight the cockpits. The pilot would get in the front seat. The navigator would get in the back seat. You pre-flighted the cockpits right up to the start engine checklist. Meanwhile, the other crew, the primary crew, is getting suited up in a pressure suit. When they're all done, they're driven out to the airplane in a van. And at that time, the backup crew would come down from the airplanes and tell you they found anything wrong with it. You want to go with this or that. The crew chief would come out. If he had any problems, he'd let you know as well. And then you got in the airplane and cranked it up.
All right. Typical missions would last how long?
4 or 5 hours, I guess.
Average, I'd say, is 4 or 5. We had, in fact, General Halloran was part of the cadre when he was a wing commander that did the Yom Kippur War, and those missions were over 11 hours.
Wow.
11 hours. But average, I'd say, is about 4, 4 and a half.
Yeah, those long ones, of course, involved long overflights of the ocean. You know, go from the east coast of the U.S., cross Atlantic through the Med into the target areas in the Middle East, and then come back. They take about 5 in-flight refuelings to do missions that duration. And we had several. We had flew 9 or 10 of those into the Middle East in one cluster. And then when Rich had the unit, they did some missions over in the Pacific that were equally long.
Okay. Now, were those long just because of the distance between your base, or was it also political as not being able to overfly certain countries that you had to divert around?
Well, the only time we ran into that was when we were trying to fly over France and some of those places. They wouldn't let us over France. That's out of the Mildenhall, England group. They had to go all the way around the Straits of Gibraltar and through the Mediterranean. You know, that added untold expenses and time to do things like that. But otherwise, it was just the fact that the target was a long ways away.
Okay. Now, the SR-71 is by no means a slow airplane, so you're covering quite a bit of real estate with a mission, even a 4 or 5 hour mission. What is your typical cruise speed ended up at Mach 3 plus?
Well, we cruise, we wouldn't go up to 3.2 until we were in the target area. Okay. Because of the heat that's generated, the friction heat on the airplane. You want to protect all the other subsystems, and sometimes that heat rise goes up very steep above Mach 3. So if possible, we'd probably cruise at Mach 3 en route, and then when you get in the sensitive area, you push it up. Is that about right, Rich?
About right.
And you mentioned heat. Obviously, with the speed you're traveling, the friction, heat builds up. Are there systems on the airplane that help you manage that, obviously? Is it more a pilot function of pilot and crew?
From an air crew standpoint, we had a good air conditioning system that keep the cockpit. We had a temperature up on the control panel. I keep mine about 75 degrees. Plus, you can control your own, inside the pressure suit, your own body temperature. But the external parts of the airplane, at 75, 80,000 feet, the outside air temperature on average is minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And the airplane on the leading edges would heat up to about 500, 600. The pane of glass right in front of my eyes at Mach 3.2 is 622 degrees Fahrenheit on the outside. So it goes from the skin friction going from a minus 70 up to those temperatures is a good change.
Yes.
You know, the temperature issue is always something we kind of enjoy talking about because it's so extreme, and people think, well, the air is cold, there's not many molecules up there. How in the world can they have skin friction? But, of course, it does happen. And then the other question frequently as a result of that conversation leads into, well, how fast can you, or what's the temperature limit? And the temperature limit and the speed of the airplane is actually based on the inlet temperature on the engine. And it's 427 degrees centigrade. And I often thought, that's a very precise number. What happens at 428?
Right.
And the tech rep used to say the warranty expires.
You've flown the missions, you've done your service to the country, but as you look back, you take the military aspect out of it. What was it like just flying that high and that fast?
First of all, a lot of people think there's a tremendous sensation of speed, and there isn't. You see such a vast amount of terrain that there's no sensation of speed, but there's a great appreciation for time and distance relationships. To be able to take off out of Beale Air Force Base in California and take an airplane over to Mildenhall and be there in 4.5 hours is just, that really boggles your mind that you can do that.
Yeah, you get a little bit of sense of the speed when you're flying. You say, oh, there's Minneapolis, and you look around for a minute, oops, here's Chicago, things like that. But there is no physical sense of, because there's nothing up there to relate it to.
So right.
The speed is almost disappears if it wasn't for the gauges.
And at that altitude, you're not too worried about seeing a void.
No, I've noticed very few. In case you hit a bug or a bird, real high.
I came real close to hitting a hot weather air balloon.
Really?
Yeah. It was through the Korean DMZ. We had one mission. You go through the smack dab down the middle of the Korean DMZ, obviously imaging up to North Korea.
Right.
And you approach it from either from the northeast to the southwest or southwest to the northeast. We were heading from the northeast to the southwest, imaging off to the right into North Korea. And I was just glancing outside, and all of a sudden I put my head down in the cockpit, and I saw something go by real quick. I didn't know what it was, but something was up there. And I couldn't figure out for the life of me until, we looked around, and Don in the back seat, he saw it coming. It was a big weather balloon. Where it came from, we have no idea.
Wow. That could have made for an interesting day. Yeah. Definitely. So, gentlemen, we're just about out of time, but any last thoughts that you have on your careers flying the SR-71?
Well, let me say something about Paul Bresnik.
Okay.
Little Audrey, the airplane that's up in the museum. That was Paul's first airplane, named for his wife, and it had kind of disappeared from the scene. And when I was president of EAA Chapter 1, which is in Riverside, California, at Flaybob Airport, we decided to rebuild Little Audrey. and we found all the pieces and parts and put them together. I made one local test op the night before. We put it in a truck and brought it up here. I flew it out over the lake for a photo session and came back and landed and parked right in front of this booth. Paul was there and Audrey and a whole big group of people, and I taxied up and parked and gave Paul the keys. No one else, well, I'm the only person then that ever flew little Audrey after it was rebuilt. And so I'm always happy to see it up in the museum.
It is. It's. I saw it this morning, in fact, as I was up there. And, Rich, you have a forum coming up Saturday, correct?
Yes, I'll be there Saturday.
All right.
Correct.
And give us the details. What time and which forum building?
That forum is in forum tent number 6. And it's going to start, I believe, it'll be in the newspaper, but I believe we start at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, I think that's right.
There's two other SR-71 crew members coming in today, so we'll have a total of 5 up there on a symposium.
Great. Who else is joining you?
Another one that's Gil Bertelson and Frankie Stamp, General Haller, and myself, so we'll have 5 crew members up there.
All right, so if you have any questions.
That's the time to ask them.
All right, and that is Saturday morning, Forum Building Number 6. Starting at 10 a.m., go see them, and I'm sure there'll be some excellent stories that come out of that forum as well.
Some of them will be true.
Excellent. Even better. Pat, thank you for joining us. Rich,
thank you.
Pleasure having you here, and you're listening to From the Stand on EIA Radio.